Good evening. You're welcome today for the fifth Slade Lectures. So today I take you to Nigeria in the 1980s and 1990s to consider the fate of art and the broader critical culture in the time of the two most repressive military dictatorships exemplified by the regime of General Ibrahim Babangida, the self-described evil genius, famed for his photogenic smile. I focus on the work of the painter Obiora Udechukwu, also a well-known poet, who during this period was at the height of his powers with drawing and paintings and poetry acclaimed for their lyrical power and trenchant social commentary. I consider the fate of art and the broader critical culture, including the work of other artists at Nsukka and elsewhere, arrayed against the politics and policies of a dictatorship that raised corruption to statecraft and impoverished the citizenry. But first, let me acknowledge two people who have helped build the field of and the scholarship in which I am only a single voice. First is my former teacher in sculpture at Nsukka, Ella Natsui. In the days when our school library did not have access to foreign art magazines, Anatsui made a point of bringing back these publications from overseas. And for my generation of students at Nsukka, it was such a privilege to visit his home and studio to stay connected with the international art scene at a time the IMF Structural Adjustment Program punishingly limited our imaginative worlds. Second is my dear friend and colleague, Salah M. Hassan, who more than anyone I know has worked tirelessly to advance the field of modern and contemporary African art through his scholarship and teaching, but especially by leading the drive, despite the odds, to establish research and academic institutions to support our nascent field. So to El and Salah, I am thankful for your generosity of spirit. And with that, I turn to my topic for today. By every measure, Obiora Udechukwu's Tycoon and Steve Dorr's, painted in 1980, is an impressive work. Not the least because the orchestration of complementary colors is, in fact, optically pleasant. Against a background that shifts from lower section of cloudy mix of carmine, alizarin crimson, and cadmium orange to the cadmium yellow and orange top, a cluster of blue-green figures sprout from the bottom into a tight, unstable bubble topped by a massive head. While the pictorial composition and narrative might not be easy to untangle, the title invites us to do just that. The flat and non-descriptive red areas do not offer us much, except for the stylized handbag suspended in midair. But it is the figural mass that holds the painting's subject. Here we see four figures with the body of one in front in full view, the other three partially behind, all carrying massive sacks on their shoulders. There might be others hidden under their loads. A head with a tall hat in circle, perhaps indicating someone of a different status, lurks in the left corner. Udechukwu has taken liberties with his representational tactic. Besides the rapidly drawn outlines, dry brushwork, and thinly applied paint, the figures are rendered in a way that suggests emphasis on the expressive power of the organic line rather than on anatomical fidelity. Except for one instance, there are no perpendicular lines. Rather, every movement tends to a curve, such that the sinuous lines of the heavy sacks create a visual cadence echoed by the two billowing arcs above them that seem weighted down by a large head. We soon realize that this head is that of a man dressed in a Yoruba Asoke cap, his eyes hidden behind dark sunglasses, his thick lips holding down a large cigar, belching distinctly red smoke. We also realize from the spiral motifs on the sleeve of one of his visible hand that he is wearing a dress made of what must be expensive lace. His stubby hand keeping his business bag in aerial suspension as if by some magnetic or magical power. Here is a man wearing the flowing abada, the dress of choice for wealthy and powerful men of Lagos, Nigeria's financial capital, center of maritime trade, and then seat of government. This setting is indicated by the horizontal boundary, the one perpendicular line I referenced earlier, of the cadmium yellow and orange at the top, along which are boats and ships. The stiff doors, and even the fifth figure who might be their foreman, are inside the tycoon's body, trapped within the confines of his bloated self, as if they and their labor constitute indigestible fodder to his insatiable craving. What is not in doubt is that by conflating the space within which the stiff doors do their work and the fashionably dressed body of the big man, Udechukwu signals the exploitative nature of the relationship between the tycoon and stiff doors. But why take up this particular subject in 1980? What resonance might it have in Nigeria of that period? And who is the real target of this important painting? Tycoon and Stiff Doors is Udechukwu's reflection on the capture of Nigeria's post-independence political economy by non-sovereign big men to fund their profligate and ostentatious lifestyles at the expense of the exploited masses. It moreover speaks to the crucial role played by this class in maintaining the socio-economic imbalance and regimes of despotic and quasi-democratic governance overseen by the sovereign big men. Tycoon and Stiff Doors is also significant as it came at a point when Udechukwu reached an inflection point in the evolution of his pictorial mode and thematic concerns. As I will show shortly, the previous decade had seen him examining and in the process refining what I might call the aesthetic and rhetoric of the lyrical line, effectively moving away from painting to drawing. Tycoon and Stiff Doors was not only his last major canvas for another decade, it marked his emphatic turn from years of probing the devastating impact of the Biafran War of 1967 to 1970 to sustained critical commentary on life and politics of the post-Biafra nation as it stumbled from the shaky Second Republic to a 15-year period of three brutal military dictatorships. In considering Udechukwu's work as I do today, let me note two important topics that it allows me to probe. First, it affords me the opportunity to address the art historical problem of distinguishing the modern and the contemporary that I raised in my introductory lecture. For while it takes as its starting point the cultural identity focus of the independence decade modernists, it is not so much in the service of a positivistic production of national culture as engaged in an insistent commentary on the malfeasance of post-colonial governmentality and its debilitating aftermath. Second, it allows me to examine the modes of address, that is, the rhetorical devices he and other Nigerian artists deployed to speak to the terrors and depredations of the sovereign and the everyday big man. But let me begin with a brief recounting of Udechukwu's work leading up to 1980 and the historical context of the critical turn represented by Tycoon and Steve Dorr's and similar work from that period. When Nigeria, with 250 ethnic groups and more than 500 indigenous languages, gained political independence from Britain in 1960, the reality of its demographic, cultural, and structural complexity soon became apparent. Its parliamentary system proved inadequate to manage the pressures of ethnic nationalisms. And in 1966, a group of young army officers with revolutionary ambitions carried out an unsuccessful bloody coup that exerted enormous stress on the already weak ties that bound the country's constituent groups. A pogrom against Eastern Nigerians resident in the northern region led to the secession of the East as Republic of Biafra in 1967, inevitably leading to the civil war in which up to 2 million children may have died due to starvation policy of the Nigerian government and their European supporters. Udechukwu, only 21 at the onset of the war, witnessed the devastation of that moment in scores of drawings and paintings, haunting images of bombed out homes and emaciated children and traumatized populations produced behind the front lines might be the most comprehensive perspective on the impact of that war by any artist. In the following years, after the defeat of Biafra, war refugees persisted as a theme in his work, even as he explored new modalities of image making, from the realism of the earlier period to the later work inspired by the aesthetics and ethic of the line. In fact, Udechukwu and his dual emphasis on a social vision initially forged by the experience of war and on the rigorous investigation of and faith in the expressive and symbolic power of the organic line points the way post-independence political crisis might have fundamentally changed his relationship with and connection to the national culture orientation of the modernists, such as his teacher, Uche Okeke. In 1961, Uche Okeke with whom Ibrahim El-Salahi and others participated in the Mbari Club that I mentioned in my previous lecture, began his first experiment with Igbo Uli body drawing, inspired by his theory of natural synthesis, which called for, as did the Khartoum school, combining the formal resources of Western and African artistic traditions in order to develop a new post-colonial modern art. A competent poet himself, Okeke, examined the structural and lyrical equivalences between Igbo folk song and Uli drawing, and sought to reaffirm this transmedia connection in subsequent work for which he will gain national and international attention. In the mid-1960s, Udechukwu met Okeke and soon began his own research on Igbo art. With his exceptional draftsmanship and sophisticated poetic sensibility, he advanced with unparalleled intellectual and technical rigor the formal properties of Uli drawing, which resulted in the visual poetry that his drawing would become by the late 1970s. Udechukwu also became familiar with the work of Christopher Okigbo, that great poet whose work impacted Udechukwu tremendously. Okigbo was an extraordinary poet, known as much for his astonishing sampling of world poetic traditions, from the Greek tragedians and Virgil to the Victorian Gerald Manley Hopkins and the modernists Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. From the symbolists Mallarmé to the Senegalese negritude poet Léopold Senghor. Okigbo equally mined African poetry, from the Ijala of the Yoruba hunters to Akan and Igbo elegiac drumming and dirge performances. Indeed, because of its layered allusions, its refusal of easy or even reliable interpretation, Okigbo's poetry is unquestionably post-symbolist, yet because of the level of condensation, suturing, and collaging of words and phrases, it is equally formalist. For the reader is often left in awe of the texture and sound of words, as well as by the silences that hold them in lyrical balance. In fact, it is the expressive abstraction in the service of poetic lyricism that made Okigbo think of his poetry as primarily an excursion into musical composition by means of textual ordering. Thus, whereas Okeke's work may have led Udechukwu to recognize the significance of Uli art and design in charting a new path within the context of modernist art, the sheer force of Okigbo's lyrical formalism and his symbolism opened up for Udechukwu the possibility of imagining drawing as a set of complex operations that depends on the dynamic balance of legible or meaningful form and evocative yet subjective graphic spatial gestures. Okigbo, in other words, allowed Udechukwu to see drawing as a form of poetic utterance, that is, an expressive statement that does not so much aspire to the realism of academic prose drawing as perpetually defer the resolution of the tension between rigorous formalism and layered symbolism. Okibo's poetry helped Udechukwu realize that the graphic line, drawing's most pervasive element, can be a potent bearer of meaning, and that it can excite our senses through symphonic invocation and allusions to color, sound, texture. In other words, he settled on a deliberate and intuitive deployment of his technical resources towards the formal refinement of pictorial elements until they approximate the lyrical abstraction of music and poetry. A third element of Okibo's poetry, evident in his last collection of poems, Path of Thunder, is his deployment of his work to analyze the Nigerian crisis and prognosticate on its devastating consequences before the war in which he died fighting for Biafra. I would argue that this willingness to draw on the expressive power of poetry for socio-political engagement is instrumental to the formation of Udechukwu's art and politics. When the war ended in 1970, Udechukwu returned to Nsukka, where he submitted a thesis in 1972, in which he documented Ulimural art and analyzed its elements, compositional and design characteristics. Here's how he described his understanding of Uli in 1998. An analysis of Igbo drawing and painting reveals that space, line, pattern, brevity, and spontaneity seem to be the pillars on which the whole tradition rests. It is these same qualities that I strive, both intuitively and intellectually, to assimilate in my work. The art historian and artist Chike Aniako, who also taught at Nsukka, put it in a more poetic language. According to him, Uli, at its best, is the rhythmic temper of a line like a melodic note plucked from the piano thumb. In Uli, the line dances, spirals into diverse shapes, elongates, attenuates, thickens, swells and slides, thins and fades out from a slick point, leaving an empty space that sustains it with mute echoes by which silence is part of sound. As Udechukwu experimented with these formal qualities of Uli, the ambition of his drawing changed from describing the world in visual prose to creating alternative image worlds through the sheer reliance on the dynamic dialogue of line and negative space. The arcing lines and decorative motifs in both his semantically abstract compositions or in highly simplified figural forms all testify to the impact and influence of Uli design and pictorial sensibility. His post-war drawings thus constitute Udechukwu's inaugural attempts to create lyrical poetry with the graphic line, decorative motifs, and flat pictorial space as his syntax. This process, executed with greater focus and conviction, reached full elaboration by the end of the 1970s. Udechukwu's insistence on the expressive properties of the virtuosic lyrical line earned him substantial critical attention. In 1981, for instance, the novelist Chinua Achebe described Udechukwu as a poet of clean and eloquent line, whose clearness of vision is sustained by honesty and humane compassion. I have no doubt that Achebe saw the artist as a poet of drawing. That is, drawing that had reached a level of formal purity on account of its ascetic yet elegant lines, which in turn implied clarity of artistic vision. Whether or not Achebe had read Udechukwu's essay titled Towards Essence and Clarity, published in the widely circulated Nigeria magazine the previous year, what is clear to me is that Achebe fully grasped the fundamental element of the artist's work during that period, that it is lucid, elegant, powerful formal expression that, like the successful poem, is shorn of prosaic, inessential stuff. Achebe, moreover, seemed to have understood Udechukwu's work as engaged at that point with inventive formal play, but also that it had attained the status of inspired utterance, similar to Okibo's poetry. But this raises a crucial question. Of what conceptual value is the clear, unambiguous, and assertive line in Udechukwu's drawing about which he wrote in 1980 when he painted Tycoon and Steve Dorse, especially given that it does not produce unequivocal images, that is, easily apprehensible images of the sort we often associate with pictorial realism? It seems to me that the clean, elegant line, apart from helping Udechukwu stake a claim to Uli art and Igbo culture, as did his modernist mentor Uche Okeke, serves as a graphic manifestation of what he called clarity of vision and lucidity of expression. In other words, it is the assertive mark of the uncompromising and self-assured artistic imagination. Having dwelt at length with this matter of form and aesthetics in Udechukwu's work, let me turn slightly away in a different direction to consider how, as the experience, if not memories of war, receded by the end of the 1970s, he increasingly focused on the broader Nigerian socio-political landscape. Few years after the end of the Biafran War, the victorious Nigerian government, led by General Gowon, benefited from the oil crisis caused by the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. For a country that until then had not fully exploited the oil discovered in the Niger Delta in 1956, the 1973 global crisis dramatically changed its economic profile and fortune. And the regime went big. Increased national spending tenfold and threw its weight around as an international power and leader of Africa. Gowon's regime splurged on civil servants as well, so wish he was ruling the UK right now. And embarked also on large-scale capital projects, but he was taken out in a coup d'etat that brought the charismatic Murtala Mohammed to power in 1975. Mohammed, an ardent nationalist, stung by the failing national income after the Middle East War, decimated the civil service in an anti-corruption campaign, but was assassinated a year later, replaced by General Obasanjo, who scaled up what was already going to be an expensive national vanity project, and that is the 1977 Second World Black and African Festival of Art and Culture, aka FESTAC 77. Despite that the country's economic fundamentals were inherently weak, it threw open the gates for a global party for black peoples, staged a stupendous musical and theatrical performance in their showpiece, magnified copy of a Bulgarian theater. And it is said that General Gowon loved the structure, the design, because it resembled a military cap. In 1979, the Second Republic, stage managed by General Obasanjo's regime, came to power, heralding new political class and economic elite, inebriated by a second oil boom caused by the Iranian Revolution, taking wasteful spending to new heights, hollowing out a supposedly wealthy nation. The newly elected President Shehu Shagari, once in power, dusted up the long-delayed plan for a national capital in Abuja and opened the coffers to fund the massive project said to be, at one point, the world's largest urban construction site, invariably worsening the country's economic fortunes. It is within this context that we make sense of Udechukwu's tycoon and stevedores, and the equally poignant Alhaja from 1978, as declamatory comments on this new class of non-sovereign big men and women who built their social power through corrupt wealth accumulation. The tycoon, fattened by the labor of the exploited longshoremen, and the socially recognizable businesswoman who has supposedly made the expensive pilgrimage to Mecca, and whose turban-like headgear drips with ornaments, her hand and taloned fingers weighted down by subtle jewelry, they both cut an impressive image of arrogant wealth. The themes of Udechukwu's exhibition in Nigeria and Europe during the first half of the 1980s are quite telling, for their emphasis on the socio-political commentary and critique of the big man's unregulated and corruptive power. In 1981, he presented No Water, that traveled to three Nigerian venues, and in which we see remarkably elegant compositions that nevertheless dealt with the rather basic problem of lack of potable water by vast segments of a nation supposedly awash with petrodollars. In one exemplary drawing, a discordant line of water pots, buckets, and cans snake from the foreground to the horizon, a single delicate line rising from the mid-distance, arcing to the right, touching a dry water tap hovering above the empty vessels. Following the testamentary posture of No Water, Udechukwu's exhibition of 1985, Rhythms of Hunger, at the Commonwealth Institute in London, referenced the impoverishment of the masses in an increasingly mismanaged economy run by military and civilian elite. In the works presented there and at other venues in Nigeria during this period, two topics recur. One, a continuation of his critique of the exploitative and corrupt big man, which we see in drawings depicting the familiar cigar and pipe-smoking big man riding a horse, the stomach of which is filled with destituted underclass. Or a group of them with their chiefly and clerical hats, and the ever-present tycoon and al-Hada to the right, all cavorting, perhaps even fighting for government contracts and kickbacks, but sullied by the muck of corruption, the hapless masses squished to the right corner. Although Lagos was the country's economic and political capital, Abuja was the locus of official corruption. A rising city without industries or any meaningful productive sector, but which readily bestowed stupendous wealth to contractors with only the right connections and who were adept at the art of bribery. This is also the portrait of the city in Udechukwu's Road to Abuja. If there's any indication of a road to the future seat of government, it is the two concave lines, one grazing the artist's signature, rising to the left, terminating in the midsection of the vertical picture plane, and a second double line blocked by what appears to be the bloated body of a dead beggar. An open truck stuffed with standing human cargo turns off the road, and above it, a woman cooks on a wood-fired stove under the streetlights. The main characters in the composition, the lords of the city, are the turbaned figure clutching a bag filled with British, US, and Nigerian currencies, as well as the Christian cross and Muslim prayer beads, as if to announce the symbiosis of faith and capital. Following this is the this fellow who might be the al-Hajja, judging by the high-heeled, you know, supposedly ladies' footwear, is a tycoon in business suit. And further back, a Christian cleric. But their rightward procession away from the crowd is blocked by a seated beggar. Overseeing this motley crowd is an imperious vulture on a lamp post. In the distance, another sits on a skeletal structure dominating the landscape. The road to this Abuja is perilous. The city itself, a schizophrenic place of poverty, suffering, and death, a citadel of corruption and fast money. It is the city of economic and political vultures. Udechukwu's exhibitions and artworks, focused as they were on socio-political commentary, had everything to do with the five-year period that straddled the raucous, massively rigged second federal elections in 1983 that returned Shehu Shagari to power, the bloodless coup that ushered in the draconian regime of General Muhammadu Buhari, and his no-nonsense sidekick, Tunde Idiabon, later that year, and another coup in 1985, led by General Ibrahim Babangida, who, with his beguiling, dimpled smile, declared a new order, shorn of the brutality of the Buhari regime, notorious for its war against indiscipline program that had been designed to straighten up the unruly and insubordinate citizenry. This was the Nigeria that Chinua Achebe published about in his incendiary pamphlet, The Trouble with Nigeria, in 1983. With his characteristic directness, Achebe catalogued the evils that had beset the country right from the colonial period, but especially since independence, not the least of which were corruption, tribalism, mediocrity, political opportunism, social injustice, and all. And he blamed all this on the absence of visionary, non-self-serving, just leadership. The trouble with Nigeria, a nation of perpetual potentiality, but in reality a sorry disappointment, Achebe argued, had everything to do with the malfeasance of his arrogant big men in military uniform or in the tycoons billowing Abada. It is also the same Nigeria that the poet Nii Oshundare, a contemporary of Udechukwu, devoted his collection of poetry, Songs from the Marketplace, also published in 1983, in which one of the poems, Cyrene, called on out the obnoxious power play of the big man. Cyrene, 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 police acrobats on bikes, wielding whips and with consummate dispatch, the roads must be cleared at once. For which worthy ruler ever shares the right way? Cyrene, 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 the clangorous convoy of power and power brokers conditioned in Mercedes back, far, very far from the maddening crowd. For poems like this, which Oshundare continued to publish in national newspapers throughout the 80s and after, and for which he gained national renown, he was frequently visited by state security to explain their meaning and to whom they referred. About these encounters, Oshundare later noted with not so subtle sarcasm, "By that time, I realized that the Nigerian security apparatus had become quite sophisticated, quite literate indeed." Well, Achebe and Oshundare represented an important aspect of Nigerian literature committed to the role of art in the making of the good and just national community. But where Achebe argued that the artist and writer, like the teacher, must educate their people about their past with all its complications, about their present as a political reality, and about their possible futures, all with the goal of building a better society, Oshundare identified with the bard, or minstrel, who through his musical and lyrical art serves as the conscience and bearer of sometimes bitter but salvific truths of society. Udechukwu shared with Oshundare this idea of the poet minstrel as a social critic, which, in fact, is deeply embedded in the traditions of many Nigerian and West African cultures. And he, Udechukwu, frequently demonstrated this through his drawings and paintings depicting the minstrel armed with only his voice and his oboe, the gourd resonator, or ubakwala, the stringed bow. In Song of Sorrow from 1989, the minstrel lowers his head in sorrow, and as a single line, by the way, an epic display of inspired draftsmanship, shows that he is crouched on a bare floor. But I wish to call attention to the figure on the right, for he is no destitute minstrel. Instead, his chiefly cap and especially his itchy facial scarification, which until the early 20th century sanctified men and women who attained high social and sacred status in the Igbo society. These symbols, the cap and the itchy marks, suggest that his music and the truths to which he testified in his lyrics, also serves as his protective cloak against the vicious impurity of the big man's arrogant powers. But why the gathering of critical voices that we see in Udechukwu's work and in that of his literary contemporaries during and after the mid-1980s? The answer must be the coming of General Babangida in 1985. Wildly welcomed by Nigerians yearning for relief from the Buhari regime's obsession with enforcing military discipline on the entire citizenry. In his address to the nation on August 27, 1985, Babangida, to the cautious delight of Nigerians, announced the repeal of the dreaded Decree No. 4 that criminalized unpleasant publications. Well, that was critical of the government, and even rumors. He also released politicians jailed since the end of the Second Republic and moved to stem the worsening economic crisis. However, within 1 year, he introduced the IMF Structural Adjustment Program with the attendant austerity measures, thus supercharging mass impoverishment and collapse of the educational sector, as well as unprecedented brain drain. And Dele Giwa, one of Nigeria's most prominent journalists, said to be working on a story involving drug running that implicated the dictator's wife, was assassinated with a letter bomb. And in the international community, Nigeria had become a de facto narco state run by highly placed government persons. Moreover, after charming Nigerians with the announcement in his first year of an elaborate program of transition to democracy, he would take the country through a ridiculous process of deception that could have made a fascinating political thriller, scheduling and postponing 4 times the elections initially set for 1990 until it held in 1993. And when the results apparently showed the businessman Moshood Abiola poised for a landslide win, Babangida annulled the elections, apparently not ready to relinquish power, thus plunging the country into a crisis of unprecedented magnitude. It is for these ornate political maneuvers that he called himself evil genius, though Nigerians prefer to call him Maradona, after the Brazilian football star's hand of God goal at the 1984 World Cup quarterfinals between England and Brazil. But if Babangida's reputation as a cunning, equivocating ruler surprised many Nigerians who had not forgotten his declared commitment to foolproof democratic process in 1986, or shocked others still enamored by his affable public disposition, or even by his killer gap-toothed smile, Udechukwu had, as early as 1985, seen him as a chameleon, dominating the Nigerian sky with 3 figures representing civilian representatives of the 3 main ethnic groups, and in between a disappearing mass of hapless citizenry, the entire surface plastered with thumbprints. And in 1989, as the transition process heated up, along with strikes by students and workers beleaguered by the structural adjustment economy, Udechukwu's ink and wash drawing, What the Serpent Did Not Say, depicted the general as a martial hybrid. He sports a military beret, but half of his body is in civilian attire. the other in uniform with an epaulet decorated with money symbols. Combined with the snake, whose invisible forked tongue is a symbol of deceit, lovingly lolling around the general, the image here is of a ruler whose utterance and action could not be trusted. And if you thought of his political footwork artful and his bonhomie benign, a close look at the badge on his beret, showing two vultures guarding two emaciated figures, signals the deadly consequences for the nation of his power play. Let me note, as I'm sure you might be wondering, that in deploying his work as a tool for sociopolitical commentary, Udechukwu was not alone among artists. And I'm not simply thinking of other poets and writers of his generation, including the previously mentioned Oshundare or Tunde Fatunde, the author of the dramatic work in Pidgin English, Oga Na Thief Man, translated, The Boss is a Thief. Or Festus Iyayi, whose novels, including Violence, insistently explored the devastating impact of elite class corruption on the society. Indeed, a few prominent artists of the 1980s joined Udechukwu in his critique of the unprecedented institutionalization of corruption in Babangida's Nigeria. But their modes of address differed. Consider, for instance, Gani Odutokun, the doyen of painting at Ahmadu Bello University in Zaria, who until the mid-1980s generally explored cultural and genre themes. But between 1987 and 1990, at the height of Babangida's reign, created a cycle of allegorical paintings on the confrontation between an imperious king and the republic. In one of the early works from the cycle, the king shares a joke with his general, rendered in the florid brushwork and polychromatic palette he developed years before. We see the bare-chested, powerfully built king with a self-satisfied smile holding a crown in one hand as he removes a rather nondescript hat with the other. His solemn-faced general in uniform holds a mirror for him. But whatever the joke, we do not know. Another painting from 1990, The King, Queen, and the Republic, we see the royal couple quietly fleeing, expelled by a sword-bearing republic. The same couple that we had seen in 1988, moonlighting, oblivious of the crisis below them. But if Udechukwu deployed a lyrical, what I might call lyrical realism, and Odutokun pictorial allegory, Olu Ogwibe, a former student of Udechukwu at Nsukka, who had gained national renown as a young, angry poet and painter, was more decidedly confrontational in his mode of address. In 1989, he presented an exhibition of his work at the Syrian Club, a block away from Dodan Barracks, General Babangida's residence. Alongside graffiti paintings on fiber mats, he prominently installed the work, and the beast had the face of one I know. A pen drawing of an amorphous beast, the head of which is collaged, the face of General Babangida. Such was the magnetic repulsion of the work that a few journalists dared linger in front of it during the exhibition. And media descriptions of it were advisedly elusive, given the threat of the still existing decree number 4. Moreover, in the poem, A Gathering Fair, published in the exhibition catalog, Ogwibe writes, "Generals, surgeons, warlords who feed on blood, carrion eaters, pallbearers, ting god who reap where they did not sow. Your shrines are empty. Patriarchs of crumbling quarters, presidents for life, founding fathers who founded only their own estates. Your shrines are empty." But for all the fear that the artwork elicited among its audience and journalists, Babangida's men never visited the show, nor called the artist to explain the work. To conclude, let me briefly note Udechukwu's experience at the last, with the last dictatorship led by General Sani Abacha, who, unlike Babangida, was reclusive, profoundly sinister, but as fabulously corrupt. A year after the regime judicially murdered Ken Sarowiwa, the writer and environmental activist, Udechukwu was briefly detained along with 7 other professors at Nsukka and charged to a tribunal for sedition and, of all things, arson. Their real crime was that the big man friend of the dictator who administered the university at the time saw their refusal to be of good behavior toward him a criminal offense. In any case, on release from jail, Udechukwu went into exile, and on arrival in the United States in 1998, created a series of drawings and paintings, including Dark Days 2. Remarkable for its pictorial quality, its lovingly and deftly worked dark surface, textured with patterns reminiscent of the mural markings of Igbo Uli painting. But to the left, within an oval space, are several pictographically rendered figures of prisoners packed into the airless space. White light bared from a window, a prison-like window, touching a prismatic line dividing the interior and exterior space, refracts into rainbow streams, bathing the enclosure in gossamer glow. In this dark night of the big men, Udechukwu seems to say, the power of truth and light will prevail. And it did. As Udechukwu was finishing this and other works in the Dark Days series, Sani Abacha died suddenly in office. Some say he was poisoned. He was Nigeria's last dictator. In the first movement of his long poem, What the Madman Said, Udechukwu writes, "Truth is iron, is my ADC. Maggots or worms cannot touch me. Truth is pregnancy. You cannot hide it at 9 months. I am frog. Jumping cannot kill me. I am wind. Can I succumb to a snare? And you are ifilifi, swallower that swallowed what swallowed the elephant. There is no escape route for your lover." Thank you.